Hello, Bo. You're very welcome on Lionheart Radio, and many thanks for agreeing to talk to me tonight. Can you tell us how you started in the music business, how you got introduced to John Peel, and how you ended up releasing records on his then newly formed Dandelion label?
Cheers, Chris, and many thanks for the invitation. I'm guessing the foundations were laid very early. I'd always known I liked music. My earliest memory is of hearing Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance, March number 4, in what would have been 1950. Of course, I didn't know what it was then. I was only 4 at the time. I was on a visit to a great aunt and uncle in Coventry with my mother and grandma, and great aunt and uncle had a gramophone and a few 78s, but that Elgar really got through. And from the age of about 6, whenever we went down to grandma and grandpa's, I started hammering their upright piano. Matter of fact, I really found nothing at all to like in the music of the early 50s to a young kid, or at least to this one. It all seemed so unexciting and mealy-mouthed. My mother took me to a concert at Leeds Empire starring a guy called Lee Lawrence, who was quite a draw at the time. I loathed it. And it's a testament to how much I loathed it that I still remember it. But then, in 1957, when I was 11, the world changed. I heard Elvis, Jailhouse Rock. This was inspirational, and all of a sudden, music was truly interesting. I loved the original rock and roll, those years up to 1960. And it was in 1960 that the Raiders were formed. We were doing Duane Eddy and Shadders instrumentals, Cliff and Elvis vocal numbers, all cover stuff that went down well at dances and functions. And of course the repertoire expanded hugely when the Beatles and Stones and all the Merseybeat lads came to dominate the scene. They were good years. But then came 1965, a seminal year, I guess, for me. This was the year loads of old electric bluesmen were being rediscovered. John Lee Hooker, Howlin' Wolf, Little Walter, Muddy Waters, all the Chicago blues guys. The Raiders had had some lineup changes and the band began covering these guys as part of our general repertoire. Anyway, around that same time, 1965, I was discovering Tom Paxton, Phil Oakes, Judy Collins, indeed most of Jack Holtzman's Electra stable. And these folky folks really grabbed my attention. I'd been writing odd bits of doggerel since my early teens, and I'd always been interested in politics and current affairs. The Electra people were the first ones I really heard that were addressing social issues head on. And then, most importantly, 1965 was also the year I discovered Lead Belly. And from him, I started getting into Blind Lemon Jefferson, Blind Blake, Blind Boy Fuller, Blind Willie McTell, indeed, pretty well anyone who was visually challenged. Oh, and Louisiana Cajun music from the 30s and 40s. That also made a big impression. Basically, I found I had a much greater affinity with the old acoustic country blues than with the Chicago electric variety. It was more personal, more raw, more to the point. So yes, the Raiders and my musical tastes were diverging. And so I left the band in late 65 and traded in the old Hofner V3 electric and bought my first 12-string. And that's when I began writing in earnest, also developing a solo act and doing the local folk clubs and unis and theatres. All that eventually led to my own Bow shows on Radio Leeds, appearance on Yorkshire Television, and eventually to an audition down in London with Clive Selwood, who was then European manager for Elektra Records, which frankly was the only label in the world that had ever really interested me. It was always going to be a long shot. The only British act on Elektra was the Incredible String Band, and as it turned out, Jack Holtzman and the label had already moved on from the folk phase and were now signing people like Love and Clear Lights. They'd had this massive success with The Doors, and that was the way the wind was blowing, which initially for me was very disappointing. Until Clive told me that he and John Peel were starting this label called Dandelion, and would I like to do an album for them? My answer, as you can guess, was short and to the point.
As you know, Bo, this show's called Influences, and you covered a lot of your early influences on the sleeve notes of your first album, where you cite Lead Belly, Woody Guthrie, Josh White, Tom Paxton and the Beatles. But funnily, there's no mention of Bob Dylan in that list, even though you later went on to write a book of Dylan's best bootlegs, a book that I've read, very, very good. Have your musical influences changed much over the years, or do you still refer back to the music that you grew up listening to?
Dylan, strangely enough, didn't get through to me until he was well into his career, a fact for which I'm eternally grateful. I always thought his writing was great. Even back in 65, I particularly loved Gates of Eden, but Paxton and Oakes were far more important to me. They were more direct. Bob could be obscure. I'm not sure I was ready for that. And let's be honest, his style is pernicious. Anyone who takes Dylan as their main influence tends to end up sounding like a poor imitation of the man. I'm rather pleased my style was fully formed before he had the chance to corrupt it. Now, bizarre as it now seems, even to me, I didn't really get into Dylan until around 1969, when, simply on a whim, I bought a copy of Bob Dylan's greatest hits in a second-hand shop. Then I got hooked. Do I still refer back? Sadly, I'm really a very unreliable fan. What appeals to me most about an artist is invariably what it was that first drew me to them. I do stick with them as they develop, but when they progress away from what it was that originally floated the boat for me, I tend to peel away. That's how it was with Elvis, to a degree with the Beatles, and certainly with Bobby Dylan. I probably stuck with him too long, actually. Elvis died musically for me when he left the army. In my humble opinion, the Beatles' greatest albums were Rubber Soul, the epitome of Beatles Phase One, and Revolver, which I thought was brilliant, truly innovative. But the later albums, the Sgt. Pepper's, the Abbey Road, etc., all of which I bought, incidentally, I truthfully found more interesting than enjoyable. Like I say, I'm an unreliable fan. I find it hard to buy into the attitudes of the unthinking diehards, the people who are blinded by habitual devotion to anyone, or anything come to that. It's alien to me.
So, are you still an avid Dylan fan? How many of those bootlegs did you collect? I've got a few, but I'd imagine you've got a lot more. It seems to be an enormous effort, and only an effort that a devoted fan could do.
Sadly, very much in line with what I've just said, very little of Dylan's output this century has done anything for me at all. Which is a great pity, because I truly believe he had genius. You know, they often say that genius almost always displays before the age of 25, before the person has an established reputation to lose. After that, so the theory goes, they may well spend their lives doing great things, but broadly, post-25, most geniuses are simply working to consolidate their reputation. I think that's applied with Dylan. That said, the very best gig I ever attended was Bob Dylan at Earls Court on the 19th of June 1978. It's a date forever seared in my memory. Absolutely astonishing night. And yeah, writing the Dylan Contraband book was an immense task and a labour of love. I collected well over 200 of the most available bootleg CDs of the time and analysed and ranked them, really as a service for other Dylan enthusiasts. Typical of me, however, my timing was appalling. Almost as the book was being published, the popularity of CDs was taking a nosedive and downloads and streaming were really taking off. But I do still think it was worthwhile. I certainly don't regret it. And people are still occasionally buying the download version from my website. Apparently it does still have a certain attraction.
Your music's always struck me as coming from somewhere, or someone, I should say, who observes the world and writes about what he sees.
I rarely write about specific events. It has happened, but not often. But pretty well all my writing is inspired either by current events or by history. And for that reason, I literally can't ever run out of material. The only choice I've got to make is whether or not I want to continue to reflect what's being flagged up in front of me. But seeing as how, in one way or another, I've been doing this since my early teens, I guess I'm unlikely to stop now. I just love life's absurdities, which are becoming more, not less, prevalent. You know why 1917 Revolution didn't get its release in the States? I only found out about this years later from Shirley Selwood. Clive, bless him, for all the best promotional reasons, had been putting it about that I was a red mist card-carrying communist, which I never was. And this being the time of the right-wing presidential contender Senator Barry Goldwater of Arizona, had apparently rather frightened the horses at Electra Central in New York. Electra were the distributors for Dandelion in the US. So 1917 revolution never got its release across the pond. Weirdly, however, in these strange Trumpian times, you can now buy 1917 Revolution and the first Bow album at Walmart. Go figure that.
In tracks like 1917 Revolution have retained their relevance to me, anyway, 50 years later. It could have been written yesterday. And it strikes me that there is a warning in there too. Do you write with a perspective of timelessness, or is it not a consideration?
Quite right. Yeah, 1917 Revolution was the very first Dandelion release. John Trevor was Peely's idea. I think he was reasoning that whilst Bow is a pretty rare name in the UK, in the States in particular, it's very common. I guess he was looking, hopefully, to the long term. The only track that was ever released as John Trevor was Skydance, which appeared on Dandelion's final promo compilation album, ironically called There Is Some Fun Going Forward.
Dandelion released some very memorable albums back then. I'm thinking of particularly Bridget St. John, Kevin Coyne, Tractor, The Way We Live, Stack Waddy, and of course, Gene Vincent. Did you know any of them? And do you have any memories of Gene Vincent back then? And I think that Dandelion album was one of the last he ever made, isn't it?
Yeah, in many ways, we were quite a tight stable. I was in CBS studio in Old Bond Street when Bridget was putting down some of her tracks. Also, God help me, Stack Waddy. Talk about loud. And I was in the control room. Medicine Head, Bridget and I did the Dandelion launch gig at the Paradiso in Amsterdam, and of course I went on to have a very productive relationship with The Way We Live, later Tractor. I'm still in contact with Jim and Steve, by the way. Hi guys, if you're listening. Yeah, I'm Back and I'm Proud was Gene Vincent's swan song album. I never met the guy. John had always been a great admirer of Gene from way back in the earliest days of rock and roll, but the man really wasn't well in these later years. He actually became the bane of John's life. Something of a sad end, really.
I'm going to move on to your next album, which was called Creation, and again released on Dandelion in 1971. And Creation, well, to me at least, it was a change in direction for you. Indeed, it was referred to as the first psych folk album. Lovely thing to say, which is quite an accolade, really. It certainly has a unique sound. How did those sessions come about?
Sometime in late 1970, it would be, Clive Selwood phoned me with an idea. Dandelion were just about to release an album by the Liverpool lad Mike Hart, called Mike Hart Bleeds, and Clive rather liked the sound that Mike was getting. So he said to me, how about we introduce a bit of subtle backing on some tracks on your next album? By the way, he added, we've just signed this new band from Rochdale, which is quite near you, isn't it? Clive was from the Deep South and plainly hadn't factored in that the Pennines lay between Leeds and Rochdale. But no matter. Anyway, he carried on, I'll send you a reel-to-reel of Mike's album. Just an idea, but see what you think. So that was the beginning. To cut a long story short, I thought it was a really good idea, particularly after I got together with Jim and Steve and John Brierley, their producer, and found how flexible they were as musicians. They weren't just prog rockers or hard rockers. They could quite easily adapt to my more folky style. I wrote all the songs for Creation in a couple of weeks. It was quite a fast process. Actually, that's not quite true. Blind Faith on the album had been written a few months earlier. I'd just written it and I was at the Beebs Wood Lane Studios in London recording a segment for BBC Two's Late Night Lineup. And I remember playing it in the green room for Clive and Joan Bakewell. That was the first time anyone heard Blind Faith. Anyway, the prospect of working with The Way We Live gave me the idea to create at least a little something that was more cutting-edge, musically, I mean. That's why we recorded Creation, the title track, in that whispered format with Jim's doom-laden bass, and why I conceived Silence Returns in two sections, the first depicting in words the violence of silence, and the second representing it in instrumental form. It did actually work. One reviewer, I remember, described the opening of Jim's instrumental salvo on Silence Returns as the most shocking moment in rock. I rather like that. And I love Jim's wah-wah on Ferris Street, my memorial song to the demolition of heritage.
You recorded a third album, 12 Sting... Gonna start again. You recorded a third album, 12 Strings to the Bow, in about 1975, but from my memory, that wasn't released until 2013. When you very gracefully give me a credit on the sleeve. It was released by the Sound of Salvation Records. What's the history of that record?
To be straight, 12 Strings was actually my fourth. I was recording a third album, tentatively titled High Mass for Dandelion, when the label folded in 72, so that whole project got shelved. Though quite a few of those High Mass recordings have now surfaced on different releases through Angel Air and Cherry Red. But even though Dandelion had gone down, I was still writing, and I was still in contact with Jim and Steve. And then sometime in January 1975, Steve rang and told me that Tractor had built a studio at Haywood in Lancashire, and would I be interested in trying it out, see what sort of sound we could produce. So I said, sure. I already had, because it's what I do, a bunch of new songs to choose from. So on a couple of days in February 1975, I drove over to Haywood with the Big 12 and put down the recordings that would eventually be released as 12 Strings to the Bow. To be honest, I didn't really do anything with them at that time, but I did hold on to the masters, as it turned out, for 38 years.
You seem to have stepped back from the music business around the mid-70s. You pursued your daytime job in banking. But what gave you the impetus to get back into the business after being away for so long? Were you still in touch with people in the business from the past?
You know, it's interesting. For a period of 23 years, from 1972 to 1995, not one Bow or John Trevor track was officially released or re-released anywhere in the world. There were a couple of bootlegs, but they don't count. But what gave me the impetus? Well, fate in a way. In 1994, John Peel gave an interview to a magazine in which he quite generously recalled the 1917 Revolution record Bow had made for Dandelion Records. He didn't know where Bow was now. On the back of that, Q magazine sought me out for a Where Are They Now article. Then in 1995, C for Miles Records issued the first re-release on CD of the Bow and Creation albums. Coincident on that, I happened to retire from the day job in 1996, and so from that point on, my energies were able to be refocused onto music. It's a bit like the story of Mississippi John Hurt, who worked for 30 years as a farmhand before re-emerging, in his case, to great acclaim and recognition, during the blues boom of the 1960s.
Had you stopped writing during that time, or were you still active? I can't imagine you, of all people, being inactive in any way, as you've always been quite prolific as a songwriter.
No, I never stopped, either writing or recording. I've had my own studio since the mid-70s and recorded several hundred tracks during those supposedly inactive years. But there was never any thought back then that any of these would ever be released. I was no longer involved in the business, and that was that. Some were very experimental, in some cases successfully so. In others, certainly not. In the event, quite a few have now been put out, either as bonus tracks on albums or as standalone albums in their own right. There's been Edge of the Dark, Deep in the Dark, Fables and Facades, all songs and performances taken from those supposedly quiet years.
You're one of the few musicians, Bo, who uses a 12-string guitar in both recording and on stage. You use a harmony, and as far as I know, you've been using it for many years. Why the 12-string, and what does it give you that a standard 6-string doesn't? I've tried playing one myself, but I can't get on with it. It's very difficult indeed. I've got small hands. What's the secret?
Well, like I've said, it was Lead Belly that showed me what you can do with a 12-string. And yes, my main instrument is still the Harmony H1270 I bought new back in 68. I'll let you into a little secret. Just in case anything tragic ever happens to Big 12, I do actually have two backup H1270s, respectively, Scruff and Smartass. Scruff's had a rather harder life than Big 12, but still plays like a dream. Smartass also plays beautifully, but has plainly had a far more pampered existence. What does the 12 give that a 6-string doesn't? Oh, so much. But it's true that if you treat a 12 simply as a 6 string with 6 extra strings, you'll very quickly get bored. Playing it as an individual instrument in its own right, the 12 string can be subtle, powerful, orchestral. They really are so versatile if you use the octave and unison courses to best advantage. Plus, in my case, I use ultra-heavy strings and down-tune my working 12s to B, 5 semitones below concert. They really can thunder if I need them to.
As I remembered, I got to know you when Ritual Echo Records released The Way It Was, which has been a big favourite of mine for years. That was way back in 2012, the year you made a surprise comeback gig in Lichfield. Keith Jones from Freedom Air and I, we organised that, I remember it well, and also featured Deck Burke and a rockabilly band called The Straight Aces. Have you got any great memories of that night? Because my memory is pretty blank. I remember the gig you did in Manchester, that was a good one. But I did record the thing, which we'll come to in a minute, on a professional tape deck on cassette. Great evening, as you have been told many times since, but my memory's a bit blank.
It was a great fun night, and thanks for everything you did to pull it together. Lichfield was the first time I'd been on stage in many years, and I was just so pleased it went down well. This, you'll remember, was the launch gig for the new The Way It Was album. And if I remember rightly, the discs only arrived late in the afternoon that the concert was taking place. All a bit hairy, as I recall, but everything did work out so well. One really strange thing that neither you nor anyone else knew that night was that I'd done something to one of my eyes in the hotel beforehand. I had really heavy floaters, and I'm just glad I knew all the words and wasn't having to rely on visual prompt. That could have been really embarrassing.
You're an avant-garde enthusiast, and you've released, I think it's 2 or 3 experimental albums as Symphonica. How did this new alter ego come about, and which musicians were you most influenced by?
Oh, since the mid-60s I've been fascinated by the avant-garde. If I was ever on the Beeb's mythical desert island, one of my 8 discs would certainly be Stimmung by Karlheinz Stockhausen. But aside from the great Stockhausen, Lucas Foss, Gheorghe Ligeti, Morton Subotnick, Beaver and Krauss, all these guys have made a profound impression on me. The name Symphonica is simply a compaction of symphonic electronica, and under that guise I've so far been able to compose and perform, and of course release, 3 albums, Song of the Volcanoes, Letters in Time and Body Mass. Absolutely no money in it, of course, but immensely satisfying.
The next track we're going to hear is Edna and Jack, which is one that you recorded for the wonderfully named The Magic of Public Relations album. What's the story behind this one?
I've said most of my songs hail from either current events or from history. Edna and Jack was inspired by the lives of 3 remarkably young women who joined the Special Operations Executive during World War II, specifically Odette Sansom, Francine Agazarian, and particularly Sonia Butt, Agent Blanche, the last surviving SOE operative who died in 2014. Before you play it, it might help a little if I mention that Rolls-Royce Merlin engines were used to power the Lancaster heavy bombers, that the O'Leary line was a recognised escape route run by the French Resistance, and Brill Cream Boys was a nickname widely used for members of the Royal Air Force, all of whom, so it was believed, had to be particularly attractive to the ladies.
I'm fascinated by all this, but not tonight. Question 14. Bo, Live in Lichfield has been released on a unique 8-inch lathe cut 4-track EP with a poster on the Freedom Air label in September. How can listeners order a copy, or indeed any other recordings by yourself?
Well, Freedom Air tell me this limited edition issue is going to be well oversubscribed and that they'll be drawing names out of a hat to determine who can claim a copy. So for those who may be interested, please email freedomair7@hotmail.com. That's freedomair7@hotmail.com. Or simply Google Freedom Air Records and click on the Contact Us tab. And good luck. My general catalogue is available through all the usual online outlets, Amazon, iTunes, Deezer. But if anyone needs to get in touch with me, they can always contact me through my website at trevormidgley.com.
But we're running out of time, as always. Can I just thank you again for agreeing to do this and for sharing your stories? It's been absolutely fascinating and absorbing, to say the least. I'm going to finish by playing another track from Live in Lichfield. This is Where Is Your Gun, My Son? All the very best, mate. Cheers. Bye.
Many thanks indeed, Chris. It's been great talking to you.